What is up, my Northwest Hills family? Worship Director Justin here, along with the rest of our church staff, bringing you another online service. I wish I could see your faces this morning, but it feels like change is in the air. We'll keep you posted on that, but for now, we're going to continue with our online services. It is so good to be with you this Sunday morning. We got a few things lined up this Sunday morning. We're going to continue with worship. We're going to hear a sermon from Josh as we continue through our series on Exodus, which I'm really excited about. We got a little fun kind of outro at the end, as well as a very, very good and wonderful video coming up from Steve Mock. So we're going to start with that, then we're going to go into worship, and then Josh is going to give his sermon. So just to preface the video really quick, Steve Mock has been involved with getting some of our funds at Northwest Hills over to those in need in Uganda, and he's going to explain all that in the video, but I just wanted to prep you with that before we got into it. It's so good to see you, church. Let's watch.
Hello, Northwest Hills. This is Steve Mock. It's so good to see you. Well, I can't really see you, so I don't want to start any conspiracy theories. But seriously, thank you for generously giving to those in need right now. As many of you have heard over the past few weeks, our church has been able to help distribute food to those in need, both locally and globally, and specifically through our ministry partners in Uganda. Last week, I was talking with our good friends, Daniel and Rachel Graham, who we prayed for in our service last Sunday. Daniel shared a story with me that that was so encouraging that I wanted to share it with you. Just as they were receiving funds from Northwest Hills, they received a plea from one of their former students of the School of Ministry who planted a church in the Sudanese refugee camp in northern Uganda. He had asked for money to buy food and to be able to minister to those who are starving in the refugee camp and to be able to minister through the church. Here's what Pastor Abdul had to share and share with us through Daniel. With your donation, we as a church of Omugo Calvary Chapel were able to reach out to 40 starving families with food and the gospel. These people included orphans, single mothers, the elderly, and pregnant mothers. We would like to thank our donors for this precious gift and for thinking about us here. We have been praying and thinking about how we can help our community round about us here in the camp, and your gift is an answer to our prayers. In fact, we have just saved 3 people from committing suicide because of hunger. Thank you for loving us. So thank you, church. It's so good to be part of Northwest Hills and how God is using us as a church to reach out to others. Thank you again. Have a great day.
Forget the wonder of how you brought deliverance, the exodus of my heart. You found me, you freed me, held back the waters from my reeds. Oh Yahweh, you're the God who fights for me, Lord. Thank you. torn apart the sea. You have led me through the deep. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
church!
Church! Church!
Church!
Hey, Northwest Hills, it's the Petersons.
Hi, Northwest Hills.
It's the Chambers family. We wanted to let you know we are here with you.
We miss you and love you.
We miss you.
We hope you have fun.
We want you guys to know we're right here with you, and we can't wait to see you again soon.
And remember, we're all in this together.
We're all in this together.
Bye.
Bye.
Good morning, Northwest Hills Community Church. Pastor Josh here. I would say that I'm super excited to be with you, but I'm super excited to be recording the sermon, and then I'm actually probably going to be watching it with you Sunday morning, so I'm very much looking forward to that. If you got a Bible, go ahead and turn to the book of Exodus. It is the second book in the Old Testament, second book out of the whole kind of Bible that we have in front of us. So we started a series last week, and we actually didn't open up the book of Exodus, but we will open it up today. So very much looking forward to that. In the story of Exodus, we see this beautiful picture of a God who calls humanity from a place of slavery, from a place of bondage, out of slavery, out of bondage, through this kind of journey in the wilderness, all the way to a place of freedom. And very much resonates with where we are today, with a lot of us feeling like we are in a bit of bondage, feeling constrained by kind of the extra pressures of life right now, not being able to do a lot of the things that we're used to being able to do. But it's because of that that I feel like God is really trying to get our attention. He's trying to say, I've got something for you in this. Let me bring you somewhere. And so I want to just be asking as a people, God, where are you bringing us? What am I enslaved to? And what does it look like to be totally free? So if you've got a Bible, we'll be in the book of Exodus. Through the story, I believe that God kind of parallels two different types of slavery and freedom. Very much as the text will tell us, we're going to be looking at the physical story of the Jewish nation, the people of Israel, who were physically enslaved to the nation of Egypt. And we're going to see God taking them from that slavery to a land that was their own. But more than just that piece of history, which is a powerful piece of history and really the backbone for the entire nation of Israel and the whole story of salvation, we're going to see this spiritual story, the story behind the physical story of God, like I said earlier, taking us to a place of spiritual slavery, to a place of freedom. So if you got a Bible, go ahead, turn there. I'm so thankful that we bought Bibles for the whole auditorium this last fall, because what would we do without them right now? I mean, we need them to stack like 3, 4, 5 underneath the tripod on the camera so we can get the right angle of videotaping depending upon if you're short or if you're tall. So I'm just really glad that we brought those Bibles. And hey, maybe someday when we're back together, we'll be opening them as well, as we have hundreds of them around here. So here we go. Exodus chapter 1. If you're in a spot where you can stand, I would ask that you would stand. If you're not in a spot where that makes sense, I just ask that you kind of take a minute and just to recognize that what I'm about to read is from God himself, as written through the hands of Moses in this case. So here we go. Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. These are the names of the son of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, my people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shipra and the other Puah, "When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. but if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and let the male children live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwives come to them." So God dealt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. If you didn't catch the message last week, I would just encourage you to go back and catch that. I would love to give kind of a full recap again, but I just don't have time, and we're really trying to do the best that we can of kind of making these sermons a little bit shorter, seeing as they're online and we're in a little bit different environment. But go back online. The context is very important because the book of Exodus really is the second part of a bigger story. We get that first story kind of laid out for us, all the who, what, where, when, why in the book of Genesis, which we introduced last week in the beginning of our series. Because the book of Exodus, the very first words, technically in the Hebrew, the very first word is the word "and." "And these are the sons." So go back, read that if you didn't listen to it. Go back, listen to it, hear it. You can read the book of Genesis if you want. But today what I want to do is I want to ask kind of one major question. We're kind of slowly going to be working through chapter one. We won't do it all today. But I want to ask one major question, and that is, why would God allow this nation to go into slavery? You know, you think about the fact that God chose this people. He called to himself a man. He said, "Through you, I'm going to build this great nation." Why then tell them that they're going to go into slavery? Why allow them to go into slavery? And not only just that, but why allow them to go into slavery for so long? 400 years is an incredibly long period of time. And then beyond just the why would God allow them to go into slavery question, the other question is, what does that matter to you and I? You know, this is an ancient story. It's a story that is thousands of years old. What relevance does it have on my life? You know, here I am living in Corvallis, 2020. Why should I care about this very ancient story? So again, God calls to himself this ancient people group, promises to the world, "I'm going to bless all the nations." But in the very beginning, God tells him, "Oh, and you will be in slavery for 400 years." But he doesn't really seem to say why. So why is that? We're going to look at two reasons today about why God allows this people group to go into slavery. So reason number one, if you're a note taker, here we go. I'm going to give you just some very practical notes. First one, let's look at the natural progression of the sinful acts of the Egyptians, right? This is very obvious in the text. We see this very clearly. But we're going to see the natural heart of humanity, which starts with pride and eventually moves to separation, breaking of relationship, to persecution, to full-on genocide in this case. And we're going to see the heart of you and I, of humanity, that will want to separate ourselves from each other, starting with pride, starting with, "This is how I view myself, this is how you, how I view you, this is why we should be separated, this is why my thoughts are better than your thoughts, my ways better than your ways, this is why you don't see things the way that I see them, and this is why you need to see things the way that I see them." So let's start with the very kind of straightforward, how this nation of Egypt enslaved the nation of the Jews. So we'll start, let's just rewind a little bit. So before this text, in the end of Genesis, we've got this story of a guy named Joseph. I'm not going to give you the full story by any means of Joseph, but Joseph becomes the great hero in all of Egypt. He is not from Egypt, but he gets sold into slavery there, and he rises to the top, and he becomes the second most powerful man in all of Egypt. And because of his great foresight, because of his ability to understand what God is telling him, he realizes and recognizes that there's going to be a massive famine in the land, and he tells everyone, and so they prepare for it, and basically all of the world is, all of that local world right there, is saved from starvation because of the great insight of this guy, Joseph. Joseph's family is from far away, and they actually move to Egypt during this season because they want to be with Joseph, and he is in a place where he can offer them food. And so they move from Canaan, they move down to Egypt, and there's this really interesting scene that happens when they are in the process of moving. So the first thing we see is this is in Genesis 46. We see Joseph is preparing to meet his father. If you know the story, this is an intimate part of the story. It's a reuniting scene where Joseph was separated from his father for many, many years, and his father thought that Joseph had died, but he found out that he was alive, and they're reuniting these families again in Egypt. And we pick this up in verse 29 of chapter 46. Then Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to meet Israel, it's another name for Jacob, his father in Goshen. He presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck for a good while. Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face and know that you are still alive." This is just this incredible embrace by father and son. You know, the father thought that the son had died. He didn't think he was alive for many, many years, but then they reunite again. It's this beautiful, beautiful, intimate piece. And then notice what happens next. It's incredibly subtle, but it gives us a picture into the beginning of the final act that brought people into slavery under Egypt. So we pick this up in verse 33. This is kind of the next thing that happens. Joseph now is talking to his brother. In verse 33, this is Joseph speaking. He's speaking to his brothers, and he is assuming that they will have this conversation with Pharaoh. So he says this. He says, "When Pharaoh calls you and says, 'What is your occupation?' you shall say, 'Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers.'" And he tells him this for a very, very specific reason. And check out what happens next. He says this, "In order that you may dwell in the land of Goshen," key words coming up, "for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians." Joseph knows that the Egyptians hate shepherds. He knows that those who are living in Egypt are kind of in this advanced culture. They're in a really educated culture. They're in a time with a lot of culture and in this kind of grand city. And shepherds, they're uneducated. They're outcasts. They're anything but what the great people of Egypt were, at least what they thought they were. And how easy is it for you and I to kind of have this position of pride where we look at other people and we think, you know what, like, maybe we're not going to say this out loud with our mouth, but we have these deep-seated feelings that say things like, well, you don't have the right education. You don't live in the right neighborhood. Maybe even your skin color is not the right color, or your accent is not the right accent. Your career is not the right career. You didn't travel to the right places. Your home isn't nice enough. Your car isn't nice enough. Your political persuasions are incorrect, right? And here's the deal. It goes both ways. It's not always, well, one person being the oppressor and one person being the oppressee. Very often when it comes to pride and when it comes to thinking other people are abominations, it goes both ways. So the Republican thinks to the Democrat, "I can't believe you would think that way." And the Democrat thinks to the Republican, "I can't believe you would think that way." Right? So while yes, it is the Egyptian in this point who's saying to the shepherd, "You are an abomination," it is very often the shepherd who's also looking at the kind of highbrow city dweller saying, like, "You're an abomination too. You don't understand what real life is out here in the open lands with the sheep." Slavery begins with pride. And in the human heart, every one of us have this issue. Every one of us have this kind of natural bent that makes us go, you know what? I can't believe right now that you are handling the pandemic like this. You know, I can't believe that you would go out and play with all your friends. I can't believe that you would go to dinner with someone, right? And then on the other side of that, there's someone who's just going like, I can't believe that there are people who think that this is a problem. This is not a problem at all. Yeah, there's some health issues, but come on, let's get past that. And man, pride really puts us in the spot where we have a hard time understanding other people's thoughts and opinions and understandings. Pride is the beginning of all of this. The next step is not just pride, but it's the breaking of relationship. We're going to see here in Exodus chapter 1, starting in verse 8, the complete loss of relationship that Joseph once had with Pharaoh. And now that relationship is altogether gone. So let's pick it up in verse 8. "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from our land." Before the king knew Joseph. So sure, shepherds, you're an abomination. You're not what I think that I am, being some highly educated city dweller in Egypt. But you can go over there. You can have Goshen. You can have this area. But I know you. I know Joseph. I have a relationship there. So even though that I feel differently about you in general, in specific, I actually know you and we get along. But once that relationship breaks, once that personal understanding of someone as a human being, not just an idea out there, not just those people, but people with a name and a face, once that's broken off, this is where persecution begins. So I want us to think about ourselves. When it comes to pride, when it comes to all these areas where we can look at other people and think, oh, you don't think like me here. You don't think like me here. You don't act like me here. Do you personally know these people? Do you know these people that you can easily speak down to? Do you have friends who think differently than you? Are there people that you spend time with that have a very different worldview than you, that view politics differently, that view parenting differently, that maybe speak a different, I would say language, but it's hard to talk to someone who speaks a different language, but someone who just sees the world very differently than you? Right? I'm not saying that all of our best friends need to be drastically different than us, because yes, naturally we do tend to flock to those people who we share a lot of things in common with, but are there people that you regularly spend time with that see things very differently than you? It's very important, right? So what happens when we don't have those things? When we don't have those things, the natural next progression then is to kind of caricature them, to put them in this like group over here, and then to try to dominate them. Right? Persecution happens. Then genocide. And let's be honest. Well, most of the time in our modern day, while we're not talking about like physical genocide, and yes, that is a reality in some parts of the world, what we're talking about is, for you and I, more likely, is this idea that we're just trying to shut people's voices out. I don't want them to have a voice because I think what they're saying is wrong. And so we just try to completely overlook what other people are thinking and saying. So we want to have a genocide of the voice. We see this real genocide, though, in the book of Genesis, which kind of stands as this backbone of this progression of sin towards other people. We're going to pick it up in verse 11 here. This is where the Egyptians continue to persecute after relationship is broken off. "Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard work, with hard service in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves." So here's the interesting piece, though. All this persecution doesn't stop the flourishing of God's people. They continue to grow, they continue to flourish, and we'll actually talk about this next week. But persecution isn't enough. You know, so the next phase is, okay, well, let's talk to all the midwives. We'll get these midwives, and we will tell them, if there's a boy that's born, we want you to kill the boy. Well, that doesn't really seem to work either. Again, we'll talk about this kind of very unique relationship next week, but the midwives, they tell Pharaoh really quite boldly, oh, these women are not like our women, they're rigorous, they can give birth before we get there. And so then you get to the kind of final stage. And this is that stage of really genocide, where the Pharaoh says, okay, any male that's born, we're going to kill them. We are going to completely stomp them out. And what's happening here? What's happening is you've got one people group saying it to another people group, I'm threatened by you because we're different. We see things differently. But I'm going to completely eliminate any voice that you have. And the plan to do this in Egypt was simply by killing all the males. Because when you kill all the males, you have all the ladies left. Well, the ladies, the plan was to just integrate them into Egyptian society. You'd either be our slaves or our wives. And that way, you just eliminate their culture altogether. You eliminate their gods, you eliminate their worldview, and you say, hey, come join us, and you eventually integrate into Egypt altogether. And that was their plan of genocide. So again, how do you treat people who are differently than you? How do you think about other people who see things very differently than you? Do you have pride towards them? Do you have relationship? Or is that something that you want to cut off and you want to put over there? More than that, do you really want to shut them out altogether? Do you want to stop that voice? See, I feel like this speaks very well to the day that we live in, because I feel like in America right now, more than anything, we've got so many different sides of opinions and beliefs and worldviews. And instead of living in a way that we can have healthy dialogue with one another, what more often it feels like in this day and age is that we're literally just throwing bombs at each other. And we're trying to stop each other altogether. We're trying to say, no, your opinion, your thought, your belief system isn't valid. We need to stomp it out completely. And it actually makes me a little bit nervous about what the future may have if we can't be in a world where we can put down our pride a little bit and where we can know people and where we can understand people. Because what happens? We're going to see what happens. We're going to see what happens to Egypt, right? Because God does deal with people who are oppressors. God brings vengeance. He brings justice. We see this as the story will unfold. And for those of you who know the story, you know what happens next. So why would God allow the nation of Israel to go into slavery for 400 years? Why would he predict this all the way back in Genesis chapter 15? Because the human hearts of men naturally want to enslave other people. And throughout history, this is what happens. Humans enslave other humans. There's another piece to this, though. And this is a piece that honestly was pretty mind-blowing. Every once in a while, like as I get to study, there are parts where you kind of map out like, okay, here's what I'm thinking about, here's what I want to communicate, here's what I want to say. But every once in a while you get something and you're just like, oh man, I did not know that that was even part of the story whatsoever. And this last week I had one of these moments, so I'm pretty excited to share with you. So yes, the obvious reading of the story was all the things that I just talked about. You know, Egypt is threatened by Israel, they're prideful, they're arrogant, they want to stomp them out, and so they do that, they put them into slavery. But there's also another backstory, there's another camera angle of the same story that's happening to this nation of Israel. So here's the thing, we gotta go back a little bit to Genesis, to Genesis 46, kind of that moment again where Joseph's entire family is moving from Canaan down to Egypt. You've got this moment where Joseph's dad, again, Jacob, Israel, kind of name goes back and forth, where he's afraid to go down to Egypt. And he has this moment with God where he basically is like, I'm afraid. I don't know what life is going to be like down there. And so let's listen to this interaction in Genesis 46, starting really in the beginning. He says, or it says this, so Israel, that's another name for Jacob, took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. Then he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again. And Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. All right, so you've got this moment where God just reassures Jacob, and he just says, Jacob, Jacob, like, don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to be right with you. I'm going to make you a nation that flourishes. I'm going to make you into this great nation, and then I'm going to bring you out of there. And he also says, like, your son's going to be the very one who's going to bury you. So it's very reassuring. Jacob's very much looking forward to going down there at this point. So that's really good. But then what about the slavery? Like, what about that? Like, what? Again, why doesn't God say, like, oh, by the way, you're going to be 400 years in slavery? And why does God even allow that? It just seems so bizarre. 400 years of slavery for this nation that God's going to bless and God's going to grow, right? To get that picture, at that same time, this moment where kind of God's people are going down, this moment where God is wrestling or God is talking to Jacob, I want you to listen to these words from the book of Ezekiel. For the book of Ezekiel chapter 20. So listen right here. Ezekiel chapter 20 verse 5. Thus says the Lord God, on the day when I chose Israel, I swore to the offspring of the house of Jacob, making myself known to them in the land of Egypt. I swore to them saying, I am the Lord your God, On that day, I swore to them that I would bring them out of the land of Egypt into a land that I had searched out for them, a land flowing with milk and honey, the most glorious of all the lands. And I said to them, cast away the detestable things that your eyes feast on, every one of you, and do not defile yourself with the idols of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And listen to this. This is tragic and it's so telling. But they rebelled against me and they were not willing to listen to me. None of them cast away the detestable things their eyes feasted on, nor did they forsake the idols of Egypt. So apparently you get this picture where Jacob's bringing his whole family to be with Joseph and all their extended family. They go into Egypt and they look around Egypt and they go, this seems like a modern place. This is really attractive. I don't know about that old kind of ancient God that we used to follow where I grew up. I don't know about that. Look at all the things they offer. Look at the things that we can worship here. And that's what they do. And let's pick it up in verse 8. This is what God says. He says, then I said, I would pour out my wrath upon them and spend my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. So apparently Ezekiel says that God was punishing Israel, that God was punishing this Jewish nation for worshiping what was not God. Again, you've got all the Jews down in Egypt in this area, and they're saying, you know what? Like, we're gonna chase all these things that are not you, God. And as a result, God says, okay, you want to chase what's not me? Fine. You could chase all those things, but you're going to get the result of that, and that is slavery. That's bondage. Because again, what's freedom? True freedom, we talked about this last week. True freedom, and we'll see this again and again and again in the story of Israel, in the story of Exodus, is God saying, you are enslaved, this nation is enslaved to Egypt. True freedom was going away to be free to worship God. Right? It wasn't just you can have freedom to go do whatever you want, to be whatever you want. True freedom was the ability to go worship God. That's what true freedom is. And when this nation of Israel said, I'm not going to worship you, I'm going to chase what my hands make over here, I'm going to chase all the things that our hands make, God says, okay, you can have that, and you will be enslaved. That's what happens when we chase the things our hands make. We shared a little bit about this last week, but think about some of the things that our hands make and how easy it is to chase those things. How easy is it to say, you know what? Like, my family, that's going to be the God I worship. My house, my career, my hobbies, my relationships. And those are all good things. Those are all God-given good things, but they're not supposed to be ultimate things. And when Israel makes a mistake of looking around at Egypt and says, you know what? I don't need you anymore, God. When we look around and we say, God, thank you, but I'm just going to worship the things that my hands make, God will enslave us. The story of Egyptian slavery is the backbone of the story of all mankind. The story of all mankind that says again and again and again, we find ourselves in slavery. And again, we find ourselves enslaving others. Right? So why would God allow this picture? Why would God allow us to, this nation to go into slavery for 400 years? Well, again, it's the natural progression of mankind who willfully, sinfully desires to enslave other people. And it's God's discipline getting our attention when we chase things that are not Him and when we worship what we make with our own hands. But here's the thing that's so beautiful in this moment of slavery, and here's the thing that's so beautiful that we got to realize, like, this was the backdrop of all of the history of salvation for the entire Old Testament and really all the way to Jesus, right? This is the backdrop that shows who we are, how God works, and our need to be liberated. Right, so what do we do with all this information today? What do we do with this? Right? So we've got this picture like, okay, here's this nation and they were enslaved and you and I have this tendency to kind of overrule people and kind of caricature them, put them over there and try to separate ourselves and try to stomp out their voices. And guess what? You and I, like, on the other hand, we also chase after things that we make, and that's not true freedom. So what do? Do we say like, okay, I'm going to work really, really hard and I'm going to try not to be prideful? Is that the answer? Is that the remedy to our problem in front of us? Is the remedy simply just to say, okay, I'm going to work really hard at not chasing after things that I make with my own hands. I'm going to put them in their proper place. Is that the remedy? Is that the answer? No, again, this story being the backstory for all of salvation history is to tell us that we will constantly find ourselves in this place. We will constantly find ourselves in a place of spiritual slavery. It is the history of humanity. But what happens when we are in slavery? When we are in slavery long enough, we begin to realize, you know what, I'm in slavery. We begin to realize there's something better out there. See, when life's good, we don't often realize that we're in slavery. But when life gets really hard, we realize I'm in slavery. And we realize, you know, I actually can't get myself out of this slavery. I need a rescue, and I can't do it. This is where we pick up in Ezekiel. I'm going to pick it up and see what God promises for his people and really what God promises to you and I. This is after that piece that we read in Ezekiel chapter 20 where God says, okay, go to Egypt. Don't worship all the false idols there. Don't worship them. They go to Egypt, they worship all the false idols, and God says, okay, I'm going to punish you. But then listen to what God says in verse 9. He says, but I acted for the sake of my name, that it should not be profaned in the sight of the nations among whom they lived, in whose sight I have made myself known to them in bringing them out of the land of Egypt. The Jews didn't free themselves. The Egyptians didn't get to this place where they're like, you know what, guys, we are so sorry. We shouldn't have enslaved you. That was so wrong of us. That didn't happen. No, God said, you know what, for my name's sake. And what he's saying there is he's saying, I made a promise that you would be a great nation. And to hold my end of the promise, I will be the one to free you out of Egypt, serving as the backbone of this whole story, this idea that we need a rescue that will not come from us. Right, so in life, when we find ourselves in slavery, when we find ourselves in a difficult spot, and we recognize, you know what, we need saving, the gospel tells us that we can't do that, that no effort will bring us anywhere, but that we actually need a savior from somewhere else. And that's where we get to the cross. That's where we get to the work of Jesus, who says, you know what, like, for my name's sake, because I am this holy, infinite, loving God who loves my people, I'm going to rescue you. Simply by you and I recognizing that we're enslaved, simply by us saying like, God, I can't do this, I'm enslaved, I need a rescue, is when Jesus says, I give my life for you. This is where the gospel becomes so real. But it often takes us recognizing our need for him and in us really being in a place of slavery where we would call out to him. We're going to see this later in the story. It wasn't until things got really, really hard that Israel finally says, God, I need you. And for you and I think going through seasons like the one we're going through are just simple reminders of, you know what, maybe life isn't the way it should be. Maybe I am in some sort of slavery. Maybe all the things that I'm chasing, that I make with my hands, really don't give me the freedom that I promise, that are promised. And ultimately, it's only when we cry out for a rescue and we recognize that God is bigger than us and that he's the only one who can save that we get the story right. I hope you have a fabulous week. I miss you. I really look forward to getting together. Continue to pray for us as we make decisions about what re-engagement looks like. But my goodness, God loves us and he's doing something good. If anything, he's getting our attention saying, hey guys, you need me more than you need anything you can make with your hands, including that church service of yours. But I love you. I will see you later.
Hi, Northwest Hills family. My name is Allison, and I've been spending a lot of time here because my dad works here. I've been getting kind of lonely, because you guys aren't here. And I hope you had a great week, and I miss you guys. Bye!